take stock. No, take a look at yourself. Figure out where your weaknesses are. Figure out where you're procrastinating, where you're not living up to your responsibilities. Consult your conscience and see if you can straighten yourself out piece by piece. Now, you think you could have a better tomorrow. You could grow up. You could be a functional adult. You could be a contributing member of society, as old-fashioned as that sounds. But it's a noble goal, especially when you're the eyes and the mouth of the state. So have some optimism because you're courageous. Have some trust in people because you're courageous. Assume that tomorrow could be better than today, and then pay attention to your conscience and put yourself together. We ask people, well, if you could have the friends you wanted, what would that look like? If you could have the career that you wanted, what would that be? If you could use your time outside of work productively and meaningfully, what would that look like? How should you take care of yourself mentally and physically? How do you deal with temptations in the way that I just described? Mm-hmm. How do you educate yourself properly? So those are warm-up questions. And then we ask people to write for 15 minutes about what their future could look like at some point down the road. It's 3 to 5 years for older people, but it can be shorter for younger people. You get what you want. You can have what you want and need if you were taking care of yourself. What would that look like if you could have it? Well, now you have a vision, right? Then we have them write a counter vision. It's like, okay, you've got some bad habits. Let's say they take you out in 5 years. What sort of hell does that look like? And how could you circumvent that? And then they have something to avoid. And then we ask them to write a bit of a plan to put their vision into practice. It's like, okay, you've got a sense of what life would be like if it was worth living. How are you going to keep yourself on track? How are you going to implement it? And so we've done that work with college students mostly, and especially with the males, it seems to work extraordinarily well. But the overall effect is that it decreases dropout rates from university by about 25%. In order to situate yourself properly in life, you have to know who you are. And so it encourages the people who are doing the program to break their life into 6 episodes and then just to write about the emotionally significant event so that you can clarify that. You can kind of clarify where you've come from and where you are currently situated. And the next part helps you do a personality analysis that can help you figure out where your strong points are and where your weak points are. And so what you want to do when you find out what your strong points are is to figure out how to capitalize on them. And what you want to do when you figure out where your weak points are is to figure out how to strengthen them. Mm-hmm. And then the next stage, so you imagine yourself a couple of years down the road, 2 years down the road, say. You think, okay, if I was taking care of myself and I was trying to build myself into the sort of person that I would really like to be, what would my life look like? And so then it asks you questions about, well, what sort of friends do you want? And how should you interact with them? What would you want in terms of an intimate relationship? What do you want in terms of family relationships? What would be your career or your educational goals? How are you going to take care of yourself mentally and physically? And how are you going to avoid pitfalls like drug and alcohol abuse? And so develop a vision for those things, and then to write for 15 minutes without too much concern about grammar or spelling, about what your life could be like if you could have the life that you wanted. And then I'd write for 15 minutes about what your life would be like if you let all your bad habits and your resentments and the parts of you that are weak and mean, let's say, and resentful and bitter, take the upper hand and drive you into the ground. And then it asks you to make a plan for the positive vision. Generally, people don't sit down and formulate a positive plan for the development of their character and their life. And it's unbelievably useful to do so. And so people who are comparing themselves unfavorably to others, which of course is definitely something that teenagers do constantly, can get out of that to some degree by starting to identify with their ideal future self instead of their current, you know, project under development. I mean, You guys, the teenagers, you guys are young. You've got your whole damn life ahead of you to sort yourself out and to make yourself strong where you're weak and to capitalize on your strengths. So the other thing to realize too is that you've got time to do this, and you don't want to panic too much if things aren't going perfectly well for you when you're 14 or 15. It's extraordinarily common that that's the case. Well, and they're not taught to have a concept of direction. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're not encouraged to. It's like the proper encouragement is, look, kid, life is difficult. Life is going to be difficult. And a lot of things are going to come your way, but you're a hell of a lot tougher than you think. And because people are very, very tough. And if you can start disciplining yourself and putting yourself together in relationship to the vision of who you might want to be, and a personal vision, right? This isn't be who other people think you should be, although that's not a bad initial guide. This is, if you could have what you needed in order to make your life what you would want it to be, what would that be? That's the beginning of a vision. And that's the sort of thing that gives you courage and charisma and strength and the ability to overcome obstacles and eventually self-confidence and the capacity to be the sort of person that you want to be, and also to be the sort of person that's useful, that's useful and welcome to other people. That's a hell of a good goal. And, you know, I think there's some key elements that go along with that, because the other thing that I would really strongly recommend to your viewers as an experiment is try to go for a month, without saying anything that you know to be a lie. Just experiment with that, because that's also something that's unbelievably powerful. You won't believe how much that'll change your life. So the rule is, watch what you're saying and pay close attention to it. And if you say anything that makes you feel weak, or makes you feel that you've strayed off the proper path, so that you start to feel weak and disjointed inside, then reformulate your language until you find a place that makes you feel like you're speaking from a position of strength, and then use those words. And part of that is, don't say things that you know not to be true, because you make yourself weak doing that, and weak people get hurt badly, and then they get bitter, and then they get resentful, and then they get mean, and then they get hostile, and then things around them aren't good at all. So that's another thing I would recommend as an experiment. You just can't believe how much that can straighten out your life. Well, sometimes you win, and then you win graciously, and sometimes you lose, and then you lose nobly. It's like it wasn't your turn to win, and perhaps you didn't deserve to win, and maybe there's something for you to learn. And, you know, and mostly what there is for you to learn is how to fail nobly. That's a victory, man. It's like with games, you know, you got to think about games. You're playing a game, and the goal is to win. But you're not playing a game, you're playing a series of games. And a series of games isn't the same as a game. And so what, you don't want to win the game, you want to win the series of games. Okay, and so how do you win the series of games? Well, you do that by being a good player, by being a good sport, right? There's an ethic in that. It's like, it doesn't matter whether you win or lose, it matters how you play the game. Well, what in the world does that mean? Because you're supposed to try to win. Well, yeah, but you're winning the series of games. And so you want to be the person that invites you to play. You want to be the person that's always invited to play the most games possible. And so that means you have to be noble in victory, you have to be humble in victory, and you have to be noble in defeat. That's a start. You have to be a team player so that you build your team, not at the, and don't take all the glory for yourself. And people see that iterated across time. That's an excellent thing to know from an ethical perspective, is that you're trying to win the set of all possible games, and you do that by being a good sport. It's a fundamental ethic. There's something very deep about it. Imagine someone's pursuing a goal, and some of the things they have to accomplish or confront on the way to that goal frighten them, and they start to avoid, and then they get more afraid, and of course their ability to pursue their goal or to accomplish their goal deteriorates because they're avoiding. If you're a psychotherapist or even a friend or a supportive loved one, let's say, you're going to encourage the person to face the challenges that are making them afraid, to face them voluntarily. And what happens as a consequence of that is that the person usually is able to overcome those fears and develop the necessary skills and to prevail. And that's partly because, not so much because they get less afraid, but because they get more skilled and more courageous. And so imagine that if you bite off a little more than you can chew, you get stronger as a consequence. And you do that in the gym, for example. When you go lift weights, you lift weights that are a little heavier all the time. And as a consequence, you develop yourself physically and you turn into who you could be. You turn into more than you are. Okay, so if you face fears a little bit at a time, fears and challenges, and you do that voluntarily, then you become more than who you are. Okay, now let's recast that in archetypal language and make it into a kind of ultimate. So if you want to become everything that you could be, then you look into the abyss itself, which is the darkest place that you can possibly contemplate. And that would be the terror of mortality and insanity and of suffering and of malevolence, all of those. It would be like looking into hell, I suppose, to some degree. And then by voluntarily doing that, then you call upon the strongest part of yourself to respond. And the strongest part of yourself is symbolized as the sleeping father nested inside the beast. And so the fundamental truth when you look into an abyss is that you don't see the abyss if you look long enough. It's like an answer to Nietzsche's conundrum. If you look long enough into an abyss, then the abyss looks into you. It's like, well, if you look long enough into an abyss, past when the abyss looks into you, you see who you could become in the form of the great ancestral figures nested inside the catastrophe of life. And then you can join them, so to speak. You can incorporate that and become stronger. And you do that partly by taking on the challenge voluntarily. And that informs you, because you learn when you take on challenges voluntarily. But you also do that as a consequence of psychophysiological transformation, because when you place yourself in challenging situations, let's say the abyss is the archetype of the ultimately challenging situation, then you turn on new genes in your nervous system and in your body that code for new proteins, and you build new structures inside of you. And none of that's going to happen without the demand that's placed on you by willing to confront the full terror of life. And so then I would say the full terror of life is something like the reality of suffering and death and the ever-present and the ever-looming presence of malevolence in your own heart and in the heart of other people. So it's evil and suffering. And to confront that is really, well, you risk blindness by confronting that. That's also a very old story. You risk damaging your vision. But if you do it forthrightly, then you discover who you could be as a consequence. And who you could be is the solution to malevolence and suffering. Nietzsche said, well, God is dead and we have killed him and we'll never find the water to wash away the blood. You know, the holiest that we have created has now died at our own hands. And he thought that was an absolute catastrophe, because Nietzsche was a very smart man and a very wise man. But he made a real error, I believe, and he posited that because of this collapse of values, this precipitous collapse of the value that unifies all values, or that is the precondition for all values, that we would be lost. He certainly felt that we would fall into nihilism, or that we would fall prey to communist idolatry in particular, which he predicted dead on, just like Dostoevsky did. But then he also said that the solution to that will be that the Superman will have to appear, the Übermensch, and he will be the man who can create his own values. And so both Freud and Jung were interested in that idea. Freud more peripherally, but Jung more consciously. And part of what Jung was trying to find out is, well, could we create our own values? And the answer he came up with was, no, that's not possible. And why? So the question is why? Well, you know, for the psychoanalysts, we were beset by fantasies, and these are sort of autonomous personalities that dwell in our subconscious, let's say, in our imagination, in our dreams, and that possess us from time to time. The spirit of rage, the spirit of lust, the spirit of envy, these ancient gods that possess us, and these values that and temptations and impulses that come upon us that we cannot control. They're part of our autonomous nature. And because they have this autonomy, and so that would be the autonomy of emotions and the autonomy of motivations, and then even the autonomy of the spirit that unites motivations, because we don't know, for example, in the spirit of play, for example, play is an instinct. Play integrates base motivations into a higher unity, but it's an instinct. And so Jung realized very rapidly that it wasn't technically possible for us to create our own values. And that's partly his stumbling upon the problem of complexity. So the world's just too complex for us to generate our values in the span of a single life, out of whole cloth, autonomously, no matter how much of a Superman we were.
Yeah.
And that partly the reason that's impossible is, well, okay, so generate your own values. What the hell are you going to do with your wife or your husband or your friend? They're just going to live by your values all of a sudden? Well, that's what the postmodernists are demanding now. The radical types, it's like, my game, right? My identity. I'm whatever I say I am, moment to moment. And there's no negotiation. And that's because they're 2 years old. And I mean that. I mean that technically. I mean, one of the things I learned, partly from reading Freud had this idea of developmental fixation, and he noticed in his clients, in his patients, that people would get stuck at a developmental level. And so you'd be talking to an adult, and all of a sudden they were 4 years old. And I learned to see that in my clients, and well, in people I talk to, I'll do that with if they're annoying me. You know, like, okay, who the hell are you? Oh, I see. You're a 13-year-old mean girl. Okay, away we go. I know who I'm talking to now. And these solipsistic identity totalitarians are 2 years old. And two-year-olds are very governed by emotion. They're completely incapable of negotiation. They're egotistical in that their worldview dominates. They have no notion whatsoever of negotiated play. And their belief is their identity is 100% generated by them, dependent on what they feel moment to moment, which is exactly how a two-year-old operates. And most of them get socialized out of that by the age of four. And those that don't have a very dismal time of it after that. And I think we have a lot of people like that now because screens have interfered with pretend play and negotiation, and because Oedipal parents and social systems have enabled a kind of immature narcissism that makes itself manifest in these absurd claims about identity. And that's all part of creating your own values. I can be whatever sex I want to be moment to moment. It's like, well, fine, but how are other people supposed to deal with that? Because they don't know what to do. Well, it doesn't matter. They have to do exactly what I want them to. It's like, hey, good luck with that. You and you Superman, you Ubermensch with your own values. Like, and this is also partly why the small L liberal types are wrong in a fundamental sense, and this would include most therapists, is like, you might think of identity and of sanity itself as sort of an internal psychological arrangement, you know? So you have your act together, it's sort of in your brain or in your psyche, and you're sane, and there's insane people around you, but you're sane. It's like, that isn't really right. It's sort of right, but, you know, you're sane if you're a reciprocal partner in your marriage. You're sane if you have three or four friendships that you've been able to maintain because you can act reciprocally. And the sanity is actually the balance between you and you and your wife or husband, and then you and your wife or husband and your friends, or you and your wife and your husband, or your husband and your children and your friends and your larger family. It's this nested thing that we already talked about. It's like, you can't be sane in the absence of that, because that's actually the definition of sanity. And it's collective as well, as that's why the kingdom of God is within you and without you. It's exactly that. It's like, yeah, you have a harmonious psyche, but, you know, are you dancing with yourself to music that no one else can hear? That's not helpful. There's a communal element of it that has to be in place. And so if you're sane, your marriage is sane, and you have sane relationships with your children, you have sane relationships with your friends, and you're a good employee or a boss, and you're a participant in the civic world, and all of that is embedded in this hierarchy that has the spirit at the top that enables that reciprocity to operate. What is your view on the book/movie Fight Club? I thought Fight Club was deeply fascist in a very interesting way. I'm saying that in some way dismissively, although I actually liked the movie. I also think it was fascist because it was a celebration in some sense of force. It was fascist sort of in the same way that the Iron Man character is fascist, you know. But I also thought it was a really interesting exploration of the idea of developing the shadow. And so
And I do believe that if men don't become consciously dangerous, they become unconsciously dangerous. And so it's much better to become consciously dangerous. And it's something that every man should really aim at. So you should be someone that no one will mess with. Now, but then you should keep that under control, right? You should be, first of all, you should be harmless and naive. Then you're a child. Then you should develop your capacity to be dangerous. Then you should bring that capacity to be dangerous under control. Then that makes you a man, as far as I'm concerned. I was a very small person in my classes and also very mouthy, which might not come as much of a surprise, and somewhat provocative. And so, you know, and I got pushed around a fair bit because everybody gets pushed around, and my weapon was to be mouthy, and it was a fairly effective weapon, although it tended to backfire because, you know, if you're really effectively mouthy with large, obnoxious people, then they tend to respond in a relatively negative physical way. And so that sort of thing was happening to me a fair bit. But I was quite proud of the fact that I had some intellectual power. And that it was then in my 20s when I learned about some of the danger of that, because I'd started to read partly Milton's Paradise Lost, and I started to understand the danger of the intellect. And the danger of the intellect, as far as I can tell, is that it tends towards pride and arrogance. And it also tends to fall in love with its own productions. And so that's actually Lucifer. In Paradise Lost, that's Lucifer. Lucifer is the intellect that falls in love with its own productions and then assumes that there's nothing outside of what it thinks. That's the totalitarian mentality, right? It's like we have a total system and we know how everything works, and we're going to implement it, and that'll bring about heaven on earth, right? That's the totalitarian mindset, and that's associated with intellectual arrogance. And another thing was happening to me. So I was noticing that. I started to understand what that meant. And I also started to understand that there was more to life than the intellect, much more. Because I smoked too much and I drank too much and I weighed like 130 pounds. I wasn't in good physical shape. And like, I had a lot of things to do when I went to graduate school to put myself together. And at the same time, I was trying to understand why things had gone so crazily wrong with the world, its encapsulation in the Cold War, and what role I might be playing in that, if any, or what role any of us were playing in that. At the same time, I was working at a prison, only a little bit. I worked with this crazy psychologist. He used to put jokes on his multiple choice tests. He was a really eccentric guy, but I really liked his courses. He taught a course on creativity, and he was also a prison psychologist, and he was an eccentric guy, and he, for some reason, liked me, and maybe because I was eccentric too, and he invited me to go out to the Edmonton Maximum Security Prison with him a couple of times, which I did, and that was a very interesting experience, because I was trying to figure out what role each individual's behavior bore to the pathology of the group. It was something like that. And I went out there, and I met a little guy, smaller than me. I was a little bigger by then. And he was a pretty innocuous guy. And what had happened was I was out in this gymnasium. It looks like a high school, a prison, which is really quite telling in my estimation. And there were all these like monsters in there weightlifting. And like they were monsters. I remember one guy who was tattooed everywhere. And he had like a huge scar running down the middle of his chest. It looked like someone had to hit him with an axe. And you know, and I was in there, and I had this weird cape that I used to wear that I bought in Portugal and some boots that went along with it. And yeah, it was like an 1890s Sherlock Holmes cape, and it was really like it was from the 1890s because this little village was up on a hill. It was a walled city on a hill, and they sold these things, and I don't think they'd changed the style since 1890. And so I thought they were really cool, and so I was wearing that, which wasn't perhaps the most conservative garb to dawn if you're going to go to a maximum security prison. So anyways, I was in the gymnasium, and the psychologist left. And God only knows, I mean, that's what he was like. And all these guys came around me, you know, and they were offering to trade their prison clothes for my cape. And it was like I was being made an offer I couldn't refuse, you know. And so I didn't I didn't really know what to do. And then this little guy said something like that the psychologist sent me to come and take you away or something like that. And so I thought, well, better this little guy than all these monsters. So we went outside the gym through some doors, like school doors. We went outside the gym into the exercise yard, I guess, and we were wandering along and he was talking to me and he seemed like a kind of an innocuous guy. And then the psychologist showed up at the door and motioned us back, okay? And so, which was kind of a relief. And so I went into his office and he said, you know that guy that you walked out in the yard with? And I said, yeah. He said, he took two cops one night and he had them kneel down, and while they were begging for their lives, he shot them both in the back of the head. And I thought, that's... See, the thing that was so interesting was that he was so innocuous, right? Because what you'd hope is that someone like that would be very much unlike you, let's say, and certainly wouldn't be like someone innocuous that you'd met. What you'd want is that the guy would be like, you know, half werewolf and half vampire, so you could just tell right away that he was a cold-blooded killer. But no, he was this sort of ineffectual little guy who was certainly not ineffectual if you gave him a revolver and the upper hand. And so... so that made me think. That made me think a lot about the relationship between being innocuous and being dangerous. And then another thing happened. I met another guy out there. And then a week or two later, I heard that he and a friend of his had held another guy down and pulverized his left leg with a lead pipe. Like, just pulverized it. And the reason for that was that they thought that he was a snitch. And maybe he was. And... that time I did something different. Instead of being shocked and horrified by that, although I certainly was, I thought, how in the world could you do that? Because I didn't think I could do that. Hey, I didn't think that. I thought that there was a qualitative distinction between me and those people. And so I spent about 2 weeks trying to see if I could figure out under what conditions I could do that, like what kind of psychological transformation I would have to undergo to be able to do that. And so that was a meditative exercise, let's say. And it only took about 10 days for me to realize that not only could I do that, that it would be a hell of a lot easier than I thought it would be. And that's sort of where that wall between me and what Jung described as the shadow started to fall apart. And that also was very useful because I started to treat myself as a somewhat different entity, because I hadn't been aware up to that point, you know, because I thought I was a good guy. And there's no reason for me to think that. Because you're not a good guy unless you've really made a bloody effort to be a good guy. You're just not. It's not easy. And so you're probably a moderately bad guy. And that's a long ways from being an absolutely horrible guy. But it's also a long ways from being a good guy. And so, but I had a little more respect for myself after that, because I also understood that there was a monstrous element to the human psyche that you needed to respect. And that was part of you, that you should regard yourself in some sense as a loaded weapon. It's very useful around children to regard yourself as a loaded weapon, because around children you are a loaded weapon. And the terrible experiences that many children have with their parents are testament to that. Anyways, about the same time, and I don't exactly know how these things were causally related. I guess it was because I was trying to figure out who I was and how that could be fixed, something like that. I started to pay very careful attention to what I was saying. I don't know if that happened voluntarily or involuntarily, but I could feel a sort of split developing in my psyche, and the split, and I've actually had students tell me the same thing that has happened to them after they've listened to some of the material that I've been describing to all of you. But I split into two, let's say. And one part was the, let's say, the old me that was talking a lot and that liked to argue and that liked ideas. And there was another part that was watching that part, like just with its eyes open and neutrally judging. And the part that was neutrally judging was watching the part that was talking and going, that isn't your idea. You don't really believe that. You don't really know what you're talking about. That isn't true. And I thought, that's really interesting. So now and that was happening to like 95% of what I was saying. And so then I didn't really know what to do. I thought, okay, this is strange. So maybe I've fragmented, and that's just not a good thing at all. I mean, it wasn't like I was hearing voices or anything like that. I mean, it wasn't like that. it was well, people have multiple parts. So then I had this weird conundrum. It was like, well, which of these two things are me? Is it the part that's listening and saying, no, that's rubbish, that's a lie, that's, you're doing that to impress people, you're just trying to win the argument, you know? Was that me, or was the part that was going about my normal verbal business me? And I didn't know, but I decided I would go with the critic. And then what I tried to do, what I learned to do, I think, was to stop saying things that made me weak. And that, I mean, I'm still trying to do that, because I'm always feeling, when I talk, whether or not the words that I'm saying are either making me align or making me come apart. And I think the alignment, I really do think the alignment is, I think alignment is the right way of conceptualizing it, because I think if you say things that are as true as you can say them, let's say, then they come out of the depths inside of you. Because, well, we don't know where thoughts come from. We don't know how far down into your substructure the thoughts emerge. We don't know what processes of physiological alignment are necessary for you to speak from the core of your being. We don't understand any of that. We don't even conceptualize that. But I believe that you can feel that. And I learned some of that from reading Carl Rogers, by the way, who's a great clinician. But anyways, I decided that I would start practicing not saying things that would make me weak. And what happened was that I had to stop saying almost everything that I was saying. I would say 95% of it. It's a hell of a shock to wake up and, I mean, this was over a few months, but it's a hell of a shock to wake up and realize that you're mostly dead wood. It's a shock, you know, and you might think, well, do you really want all of that to burn off? It's like, well, there's nothing left but a little husk, 5% of you. It's like, well, if that 5% is solid, then maybe that's exactly what you want to have happen. The Israelites are wandering around in the desert, and what happens? Well, the same thing happened to them as is happening to us. They're worshiping false idols, and they're tempted. And it's no wonder they're tempted, because, well, they're in the desert. It's like, it's not going so well. It's no wonder they're having a crisis of confidence, you know? And maybe they're pining for the old days, and they're not so sure that the God who informed them that being the subjects of tyranny was wrong, because now here we are in the desert. And so they lack faith. And it's understandable. But despite it being understandable, and this is one of the harsh things about the story, what does God do when he hears their complaints? He sends poisonous snakes in there to bite them. I think that's pretty brutal, you know, and that's the sort of thing that makes the technical atheist type sort of recoil about the conceptions of God in the Old Testament. It's like, it's not exactly what you'd expect in some sense from an all-merciful being. It's like, you got these poor Israelites. First of all, they were in the tyranny. Then they had to go across the Red Sea. Now they've been wandering around in the desert, and that's not good. And so your best solution is to send a bunch of snakes in to bite them? But you think, well, you know, even if you're in the desert after a tyranny and you lose faith, then the snakes are going to bite you, right? Because that's what happens. Because if you're in, you know, a little analog of hell, and you lose your faith, is that going to make it worse or better? And the answer is, well, I have reason to lose my faith. It's like, fair enough. That isn't the question. The question is, what happens if you lose it? Or you start looking for faith in the wrong directions? And the answer is, hell gets a little deeper. That's one of the things that really frightened me. I spent a lot of time studying atrocity, and I realized on a metaphorical level that the reason hell is a bottomless pit is because no matter how bad it is, there is some bloody stupid thing you can do that will make it worse. Okay, poisonous snakes. And so now the Israelites are not only lost, but they're being bitten by venomous creatures. And, you know, there's an echo of the snake in the Garden of Eden in that story. And so finally the Israelites, they get kind of tired of being bitten by the snakes. And they go to Moses and say, you want to have a chat with God? Because you seem to be in there fairly tight with him. How about you get him to call off the snakes and maybe we'll behave a little better? How's that for a deal? And Moses says, okay, I'll see what I can do. And he goes and has a chat with God, which is no trivial matter. And God doesn't do what you'd expect, because what you'd expect, like, and this would even work in terms of making it a comprehensible narrative, you'd think, okay, all right, guys, you've been bit enough, no more snakes. But that isn't what happens. And I think the reason that it doesn't happen is because there's no getting rid of the snakes. I think that's also why there's a snake in the Garden of Eden, is there's just no getting rid of the snakes. You have to learn to contend with them. It's more that. Or maybe it's better to learn to contend with snakes than it is to inhabit a world where there's no danger. Maybe it's something like that. I don't know. Anyways, God says something extremely surprising and very interesting from the perspective of a clinical psychologist. He tells Moses to cast snake in bronze and to raise it up on a staff. And the staff seems to me to be a reference to the staff of Moses. And that staff of Moses is something like the thing you put in the ground to orient yourself with. It's the staff of God too. And it's sort of like an axiom. And maybe it's like the tree of life. It's like, here I stand. It's a center point. It's all of that. In any case, you put the snake up on the staff. That's also the symbol of healing, right? The physician symbol of healing, the staff with the snakes. And so it is a symbol of transformation. And partly that's because snakes shed their skin and are reborn. And so they're viewed as agents of transformation. And so that's all lurking in that symbol. And then God says, get the Israelites to go look at the snake on the staff, and then the poison won't poison them anymore. And I read that as a clinician. I thought, that's really interesting, because one of the things that we learned, all schools of psychotherapy learned in the last 100 years, is that if you get people to voluntarily confront what makes them afraid and what makes them want to avoid, then they get better. It's curative. And so that's the message there. It's like, well, if something is terrifying you, pay more attention to it. And that's actually what you teach people in psychotherapy. I mean, there's a variety of psychotherapeutic techniques, but exposure is probably the cardinal technique. It's like, if I can find out what you're avoiding and get you to confront it voluntarily, you'll get better. And the reason seems to be is that if you get people to confront what they're afraid of, and sometimes what disgusts them, but what they'd like to avoid, let's say, if you get them to confront it voluntarily, that could be the future even, you know, the indeterminate future. They don't get less afraid. They get braver. And that's different. It's not like they get accustomed to what they're looking at and they're no longer afraid. That kind of happens, but it isn't really what happens. What really happens is they discover there's a lot more to them than they thought. Part of the reason that my lectures, I would say, have been successful to the degree that they have been is because people find them encouraging. And that actually seems to work, like it seems to be positive. Because it isn't necessarily
good news.
Well, it seems to be. Yeah. I mean, it isn't necessarily the case that that would be the case, you know, because it could have been that I would have said encouraging things to people. There's more to you than meets the eye, and you're capable of more than you're demanding of yourself. And, you know, if you took on your responsibility and faced the things that you're trying to avoid, that your life would be richer and better and for you and for everyone around you. And the result of that could have been that thousands of people would come to me and say, you know, I gave that a pretty good shot, and your advice is really awful, and everything is, well, seriously, like, I took on that responsibility, it just bloody crushed me, and I'm way worse off than I was before, and everything's gone to hell around me, and like, thanks a lot, buddy. And that, it's not like that's a completely incomprehensible possibility. But that doesn't seem to be what happens. Is what generally happens is that young people in particular, but not only, come to me and say, look, I've been trying to take on more responsibility and to face the things I've been avoiding, and everything is way better. It's like, okay, well, isn't that something?
Maybe onto something.
Well, then you ask yourself, well, what's the limit of that? Because that's the religious question, fundamentally, is, well, if you took on all the responsibility you could take on, and you faced everything that you needed to face, what would you be like? Who would you be? And how would the world transform around you? And, well, if the partial answer is, well, if I do that a little bit, things get a fair bit better, then the next question might be, well, what if you did that completely? And I don't think that's possible in some sense, right? It's like, you know, perfection is a horizon that always recedes, but it isn't obvious to me what the upper limit of that is. And certainly we do see people, I mean, saints,
let's say. Yeah, that's what you say. It's a Mother Teresa. It's a Francis of Assisi.
Who kind of push the limit, and they miraculous things happen around them, maybe in the literal sense, and if not in the literal sense, close enough, you know, for all intents and purposes. And so that's heartening. I tear myself apart about this in many ways because I think perhaps it's possible to take on too much responsibility and to crush yourself as a consequence. Maybe that's a sin of pride. Who knows? It's certainly possible. But my experience so far has been that when you see people bear their suffering nobly, there's nothing in that but good. That's something. And then when you see people take on more responsibility and decide that they're going to aim up and confront their suffering honestly and forthrightly, that their lives get better and the lives of people around them get better too. And so that's very strange as well, because it also means that the pathway to less suffering is through suffering, right? And that's kind of, that would be hopeful if the world was constituted that way. It's like, well, there's suffering. How do you make it worse? Run away. How do you make it better? Confront it. Yeah, but it's suffering. It's like, yeah, but it's there. There it is. It's right there. It's a precondition for existence or something like that. And it's like you have something important to do as well. And you confront it, and that's the pathway to transcending it. Probably. It's rough. Maybe we wish it would be different, and maybe we don't, too.
First of all, I do not believe that compassion is an untrammeled moral virtue, and I think one of the terrible things about our society, one of the deadly Oedipal things about our society, is that we've put compassion in the highest place, unthinkingly. And compassion is for infants. And I really mean that technically. So, like, if imagine that your ethic was that you were 100% compassionate. Okay, so what are you like? Well, you're like a good mother with a child under 6 months of age. Because human babies are born premature in some fundamental sense. So, you know, the average gestation period for a mammal of about our size should be 2 years. And so our babies are born radically premature, and there's complex reasons for that. One is that there's an evolutionary arms race between the circumference of the infant's head and the dimensions of the pelvic hole through which the baby has to pass to be born. And if the pelvis of women was any wider, they couldn't run. And if it was any narrower, then the child would die, like many children did, right? I mean, the human birth mortality rate was abysmal right up till about, well, certainly 100 years ago. And the baby's heads are compressible, right? The bones aren't fully formed when they're born. And often kids are born and their heads are cone-shaped because they've been subject to such pressure during birth. So it's a really, it's a narrow needle to thread. And there's been a lot of evolutionary tinkering to get that right. So, you know, our infants are born unbelievably helpless. And they are basically prenatal until they can crawl, and that's seven or 8 months. And so prior to that, because they're so utterly helpless, everything they do has to be regarded as above moral reproach and 100% right. And so if you have an infant who is crying, who's 6 months old or 4 months old, your job is not to judge the infant or to punish the infant or to discipline the infant. It's like the infant has a problem, and all of your attention is to be focused on solving that problem. Period. 100%, that's it. And that's great for people who are under 6 months. But it's deadly. It's increasingly deadly as the child matures, because that kind of all-encompassing, I will do everything for you, is also the enemy of development. And that's the whole Freudian nightmare. I mean, that's what Freud put his finger on, and he knew that was the pathology of the age, the Oedipal mother. And it's like, yeah, well, welcome to the age of the Oedipal mother, everyone,
because that's certainly what we see now. And so if you put compassion in the highest place, well, then that's what you have, is you have a state of being where everything is an infant. And the only hallmark of ethic is pity. Now, Jung talked about classic conceptions of what is in the highest place, God. He said, well, God rules with two hands, mercy and justice. And that's that discrimination. You know how bad discrimination is. It's like, well, no, it's not. It's differentiation. It's judgment. It's putting things in their proper place. It's setting the highest above the lowest. It's formulating a pathway for further development. You know, a mother might say, you're just fine the way you are. But what's that to say to someone who's, well, 10? It's like, you're not fine the way you are. You're 10. You got a lot of growing up to do, and you're probably not fine the way you are when you're 20. It's like you're just a fraction of what you could be. And if it's all maternal compassion, and I mean that in the symbolic sense, it's all maternal compassion, it's, well, where's the impetus for development? And there's no judgment there. And I think the most dismal thing you can tell 18-year-old boys in particular, especially if they're miserable, is, well, you're just okay the way you are. And they're not, first of all, and no one thinks they are, including them. Well, they don't. No one gives a damn about malfunctioning 18-year-old boys. Like, you know, but you can say with the proper admixture of justice and mercy, it's like, yeah, well, you know, you're not so bad for 18, and you could be way more, and good for you. And then you can encourage that. And that's the spirit of justice. And that's a patriarchal spirit, fundamentally. Right. It's the encouragement and the calling forth of further development. There has to be allowance for imperfection and error. Well, also orientation towards the aim. Yeah, and getting that balance right. Well, that's part of what consciousness does, I would say, is it constantly adjudicates between those two higher order principles. Now, those aren't the only principles, but and there's no final solution to that, right? You can't just say, well, we're all compassionate and we're done with it. It's like, no. And it's an ongoing problem, right? With your kids, you're always wondering, they make a mistake. It's, well, how much do you forgive them? And how much do you say, you know, how about you don't do that again? It's really embarrassing. It's terrible for you. If you replicate that error, your life is going to be a bloody catastrophe. You're old enough to figure it out. It's like, clue in. And you might say, well, who loves the child more? The one who says, oh, it's okay, everything you do is lovely, which it isn't. Or the person who says, you could do better. And, you know, the answer is, well, it's a discussion between those two viewpoints constantly, because, and in your relationship with yourself, well, it's like, how much do you forgive yourself? And the answer certainly is zero. It's not zero. That's, no one can live without being able to forgive themselves to some degree. But by the same token, you know, you don't want to let yourself off the hook for every idiot error you make.
Let's say there's something going on at your workplace and you need to object to it because it's driving you crazy. And you talk it over with your wife so that you've got your head screwed on straight. You say, oh, I've got to say something. And you go there and you say something and, you know, you're stumbling and awkward and all of that. But you watch the response. And maybe you get what you're aiming at, maybe you don't, but you've learned a bunch. You've learned, well, I'm not as coherent as I could be. I'm not as good at putting my arguments together. My boss is more of a son of a bitch than he thought he was. This is a worse problem than I knew about. It's like differentiated. So now the landscape is higher resolution, and so are you. Well, so good. So maybe you're a little bit better prepared the next time you have to do that. And so the issue here, to some degree, is don't lose an opportunity to grapple with something that objects to you, especially when the objection is rather small. Because that's something you say, well, I can put up with it. It's like, fair enough, like you don't want to make everything into a war. I usually use a rule of three. If we're interacting and you do something that I find disruptive, I'll note it. It's like, potential dragon, gone. And I leave it be. And then if you do it again, I think, oh yeah, that probably wasn't merely situational, but I'll leave it be because that's still not enough evidence. But if you do it a third time, then I'll say, hey, I just noticed this. And you'll say, no, that didn't happen. And I'll say, yeah, not only did it happen, but it happened here and it happened here, and I'm not making this up. So there's something going on here. Like, I'm not ignoring it, and we can get to the bottom of it. And then they'll come up with a bunch of objections about why that isn't necessary, and you push those aside, and they'll come up with a few more objections, and they'll push those aside, and then usually they'll get mad or burst into tears, And if you push that aside, then you get to have a conversation. Right, and then you can solve the problem. But man, you got to be a monster, because first of all, you need 6 arguments about why their objections aren't going to stop you. And then you have to not be intimidated by the anger, and you have to not be swamped by compassion about the tears. And then you can have a conversation. And people don't do that. They won't do that. And so they don't solve the problems. And so then the problems accrue, right? And if they accrue over 15 years of a relationship, they end up fat, ugly, and in divorce court. So, and that's, you know, that's not a great outcome. If there's something you want, you need about 5 arguments about why you want it. Because the probability that the person who's opposing you will have 5 arguments about why you shouldn't have it is very low. They just won't have thought it through enough. So the other thing that happens in the future authoring exercise is that you're asked to articulate the reasons for all the goals that come out of your vision of the future. So you're asked, like, why would it be good for you? Why would it be good for your family? Why would it be good for broader society? So that gives you 3 levels of argumentation right there. And if you have it articulated down into detail and it's related to other important goals, then you're a hell of a thing to argue with, because people just aren't that deep, by which I mean they just don't have that many levels of explanation or objection. And it's also really useful in relationship to your own mind, because if you want to do something that's difficult and that requires energy, a lot of different subsystems in your mind are going to throw up objections. It's like, well, maybe that isn't what you should be doing right now. Maybe you should be doing the dishes or vacuuming or watching TV or looking at YouTube. Or if you're really sneaky, when you're trying to do something hard, what your brain does is give you something else hard to do that's not quite as hard, so that you can feel justified in not doing the thing you're supposed to because you're doing something else useful. And if you give in to that temptation, which you often will, then it wins, and because it wins, it gets a little dopamine kick and it grows stronger. Anything you let win, the internal argument, grows. And anything you let be defeated shrinks, because it's punished. It doesn't get to have its way. So that's another thing really to remember. Don't practice what you do not want to become. The you that emerges as a consequence of your latest catastrophe is everything that you were before plus something more. And that actually constitutes what you might describe as measurable progress, right? And that's another argument against moral relativism, because if you can do everything that you could do before and you can do some more things, we could just define that as better. It's not a bad definition. And then we have an up. It's like what you're trying to do is to differentiate the world and differentiate yourself. And every time you undergo one of these revolutions, then hopefully both of those things happen. And then there's a moral to that story too, which is do it voluntarily, and maybe do it, don't wait for it to happen catastrophically. Keep your eyes open. And when something goes a little bit wrong that you could fix, fix it. Don't say, no, that doesn't matter. Maybe it does matter. Maybe it is matter. Maybe it's exactly the matter out of which you should be built. Maybe it's the matter out of which the world should be built. And if part of you is telling you it matters, what it means is that that part is telling you that there's something there that you need to engage with. That's what it means for something to matter. I really get a kick out of the word matter, because it's got these 2 weird meanings, right? There's the matter that everything is made out of, that materialists think everything is made out of, and that's just dead matter. And then there's the matter that life is made out of, which is what matters. And now and then you're moving through life and something matters. It's calling to you. And that's the unrevealed world trying to reveal itself to you. And all you have to do is allow it to reveal itself to you. And then maybe what happens is that a minor shift in shape is all that has to happen to you. You don't have to burn right down to the bloody egg and hatch out, you know, as a newborn. Maybe you can just repair a little bit of something that's gone wrong with you, and so you can undergo a sequence of continual micro-deaths instead of waiting for the bloody catastrophe that might send you so far down that you'll never recover.
And all you have to do is attend to what matters. And your whole nervous system is, it's doing this for you. You've got a goal, something happens, it matters. So what are you supposed to do with that? You're supposed to fix it. You're supposed to engage with it. That's why it's calling out to you as if it matters. It's saying there's an indeterminate part of the world here that wants to manifest itself into fully articulated being. And it's calling to you to do that. And if you ignore it, then it accumulates. And if it accumulates, it turns into the dragon of chaos. And then it waits until you're not at your best, and then it eats you. And that's the alternative. So that seems like a bad plan. In the Mesopotamian rituals, the Mesopotamians would act out the collapse of the kingdom into chaos, essentially, at the New Year's festival. It's kind of what you do when you make resolutions, because, like, it's a degenerate, what you'd say is our proclivity to make New Year's resolutions, sort of a degenerate ritual. And I don't mean that it's bad, I mean that it's the remnants of something much grander. So the idea was, well, the Mesopotamians would take their emperor outside the city, the walled city, and once a year, and they would make him kneel, and they'd take off all his king clothes, and then they'd whack him with a glove, if I remember correctly. The priest would do that, and then they'd make him recount all the ways that he wasn't being a good emperor that year. He wasn't being a good Marduk, because that was who he was supposed to be on Earth, and that's the guy with eyes all the way around his head, speaks magic words, and transforms chaos into order. That's what the emperor is supposed to do. And so the question would be, okay, you're emperor. It's like, have a little humility here because you're not God incarnate. You probably made some mistakes. Can you think of any ways in the last year that you didn't take every advantage of every opportunity you possibly could have to take some spare chaos and transform it into habitable order? That's a good thing to think about. Well, that's what you're thinking about when you make a New Year's resolution, even though you don't know it. It's like, well, could you be a better person in the upcoming year? Well, you can imagine the flood, and then you can set yourself straight, and then you can prepare for it. And that means maybe you can stave it off, but it also means that maybe even if you don't stave it off, you could ride it out. And that's actually the story of Noah. Because what happens with Noah is that he can see that things are not good and that there's a flood coming. And God is maybe letting him know. And it says in the story that Noah walked with God. Remember, and that's what Adam did before he got all self-conscious about the whole thing. He walked with God. We'll talk about that more next time. But what that would mean maybe is because Noah was straight and he put himself together, and his familial relationships were good, because it also says that his antenna were working. And he could see a little farther into the future than someone whose vision was completely obscured by fog and chaos. And he could tell that things were not going to go well. And so he prepared for it. And because he prepared for it, well, then things actually went pretty well for Noah, even though the flood came. And the same applies in your own life, is that there are floods coming. You can bloody well be sure of that. That's absolutely 100% certain. Some of them are going to be personal. Some of them are going to be familial. Some of them are going to be social and political and economic. It's like, are they going to be catastrophes for you? Or are you going to ride them out? Are you going to prepare? Well, the first issue might be, well, do you have your act together well enough to see them coming with enough advance warning so that you can take proper measures? Maybe just to sidestep it. Maybe just don't go where the flood is going to be. That's a simple thing. But maybe you don't have that luxury, right? And so it is going to be a catastrophe. Maybe someone in your family is going to get really, really sick, right? And maybe there's just a tiny pathway through that everything doesn't fall apart. It doesn't end in divorce, it doesn't end in death, it doesn't end in sorrow, it doesn't end in catastrophe, but the margin of error is like slimmed down to virtually zero. And every imperfection that you bring to that situation is going to increase the probability that that tragedy is going to turn into something indistinguishable from hell. And that's coming. It's coming your way. Absolutely, certainly. And so then you might think, well, since it's coming your way, maybe the best thing to do is to put yourself together, so that when it comes, it can be the least amount of awful possible. If people
did what they could to speak the truth and pay attention, then maybe the tragedy that's part of life wouldn't have to deteriorate into the unbearable hell that doesn't have to be part of life. And maybe we could actually tolerate the tragedy, or maybe we could even rise above it, or maybe we could even mitigate it, you know, because we can, we do that sort of thing all the time. And so it's always an open question. And Iliad had put it very well. Are the floods the consequence of the fact that things fall apart? Or are the floods a consequence of the fact that people make mistakes that they know they shouldn't make and make anyways? They sin, right? And that's to miss the mark, right? Because that's an archery term, to sin. And that means maybe they don't even specify the damn target, which is really, you're not going to hit it unless you specify it. Or having specified it, they just say, oh, to hell with it. It's not that important. It's like, you got to be careful when you say something like, to hell with it. It's not that important. Because one of the things that might happen to you if you say, to hell with it, it's not that important, is that you might actually end up in hell for a pretty prolonged period of time, or maybe for the remainder of your miserable existence, because it's certainly the case that people do exist there, and I've seen them exist there, and once you're there, it's no trick, it's no simple matter to get the hell out. And so it might matter that the things that matter get addressed. It might matter that you do what you can to walk with God. Like I said, we'll talk more about that next time. And it might be that that is how you build an ark and are protected from the flood, even if the damn thing comes. And the thing is, it will.